and welcome to Through the Pinard, your conversational podcast talking to midwives around the world about the research they are doing to improve midwifery practice. This research can range from small quality improvement programs and projects to those starting partway through or just finishing their postgraduate studies, and to those that have been there, done that, and got the t-shirt. So settle back and enjoy the conversation. And remember, you can continue the conversation on Twitter after you finish listening. Thank you very much for joining me today. As per usual, can you please introduce yourself?
Oh, hi, Liz, and thank you for the opportunity. My name is Annette Briley, and I'm Professor of Women's Health and Midwifery at Flinders University currently. I've been a midwife for a long time. I never intended to be a midwife. Still don't know what I want to do when I grow up. And I've just taken various opportunities on the way, and suddenly here I am in Australia, the other side of the world, just taking opportunities.
And we kind of joke that you kind of just got into Australia before the border shut for COVID last year. So
absolutely. Absolutely. But I didn't, it's nothing to do with me really, yes. It's not exactly as we planned. So we arrived on the 20th of January, and I started work here at Flinders on the 3rd of Feb. And the March, it all really kicked off. So there you go. Hey.
So what got you into midwifery in the first place? Because you're dual degree.
So I am. Well, I'm not actually. Not entirely true. I don't have a first degree, because I'm old enough that nursing and midwifery were, you went to a school of nursing and did your nursing, and then onto a school of midwifery. So basically, I never intended to be a nurse or a midwife. I was going to study art and fashion, but I needed a maths O level in the UK in those days, and sadly failed it twice. And my headmistress said to me, do you know what, Annette, I could really see you in a caring profession, sort of nursing or teaching. And I thought, oh, in the course of a day, I talked myself into nursing, so that when I told my parents that I'd failed the flipping thing again, it wouldn't be too much of a disappointment. And my grandfather at the time just laughed his socks off. He said, you'll never last, you'll never manage it. Anyway, so I duly went off and did my nurse training as you had to do. So I was a state registered nurse in the UK, and at the end of my training, similarly, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So I worked on, I had trauma contracts, so I did A&E, ITU and the trauma wards. So I looked after a lot of young lads who'd come off their motorbikes and old ladies who'd broken their femurs. And then about 6 months or so, I had a great uncle who visited the UK from New Zealand, who was a doctor. And he said, you know, if you did your midwifery, I'd sponsor you to come to New Zealand. And I thought, I didn't enjoy my obstetric experience and my training that much, really. But I reckon I could do that. And I'd always kind of fancied travelling. So I thought, well, if I apply, and I apply to the same place as I did my first course, if I wasn't any good, they wouldn't accept me. So I was so uncommitted to it, really. Anyway, so I duly applied and was accepted and started the course. So I was the first of the 18-month training in the UK. And I actually met my now husband, just before I started my training. And about halfway through, we decided that we wanted to get married. So when Gary asked my dad if he could marry me in the old-fashioned way, my dad said, yes, you can, but you mustn't stop her doing her midwifery training. She must qualify. And so whenever I had a bit of a wobble, as you do during your training, Gary would say, you can't leave, you have to finish. And so I actually got the results of my finals on the Tuesday and got married the following Saturday. So
getting it all done.
Right at the end of my training and didn't really travel at that point.
No.
So I worked in my training hospital for a little while, but had a very old car that broke down on a regular basis, and Gary got a bit fed up with coming to pick me up because we couldn't afford to live in nearer to London where I was working. So we moved down to Kent. And so when there was a new hospital there, I applied for a post and got a post there as a staff midwife. I got a sister's post within a year, and then worked there for quite a long time, really. Had children, so in those days you were demoted when you had children, so I then went back to being a staff midwife again, but was lucky that there was a doctor who was very keen to set up a fetal assessment unit. So he supported two of us to learn to scan. Mm-hmm. So I learned to scan and managed the fetal assessment unit with my very good colleague, Debbie Dunn, who is still a really good friend. And we were lucky. We had a lot of opportunities in those days. So I was one of the first midwives to learn to scan, and was taught by Sarah Kenyon, who is now a professor at Birmingham University, who we followed each other. So she went into scanning about a year before me, and she went into research about a year before me. And I think she'll probably eventually retire about a year before me as well. So we've sort of matched each other all the way through our careers, which has been a true delight. And I would count her a really good friend and a fantastic mentor and peer supporter of me. Then one day I was working in the unit, and it was really busy, and I had loads of time owing. And I thought, I just had what I would call a sodden day, I just thought, I've had enough of this. They knew that I lived near the local hospital. I'd got three young children by then. My husband had his own business, and they thought they could treat me however they liked, and I would just put up with it. And in fact, it was, I had had this really, really busy day, but the week before we'd had a baby that was, I'd scanned the woman, and I knew that there was something wrong, but I couldn't actually put my finger on what. The image was really murky. The baby had a really odd position with a really extended neck. And I'd scanned her before, so I knew that it wasn't an abnormality, and I just couldn't work it out. And the baby was really still. It was moving, but it was still. Heart rate was fine. CTG was fine. But I said to the consultant, I'm really worried about this woman and I'm really worried about this baby. And he said, what do you think needs to happen? And she was 38 weeks. And I said, I think this woman needs to be delivered. Yeah. And anyway, so they in fact, she ended up having a cesarean section for fetal distress with like one prostate. And the baby came out with an Apgar score of 2. Ooh. And the baby, what I could see was the cord was round the baby's neck, wrap, wrap, wrap. So that was why the neck was extended. And it was so blurred because it was thick, thick, thick meconium.
Oh.
And I just thought, do you know what? I don't earn enough money for a consultant to be writing a cesarean set, you know, baby, the cesarean section indicated as per staff midwife Briley's request or advice. And I was like, hang on a sec, there's something wrong here. I mean, I have to say, the consultant was amazing. And he said to me on that day, he said, whatever you do in your whole career, you saved a baby's life today.
Yeah.
And you know, I've kind of held that with me. So it was kind of good and kind of bad. So anyway, so that was the week before. And then I had this day where I just had worked from 7:30 in the morning till 4:30 in the afternoon without a break. No one had come to relieve me. I'd been accosted by the nursing officer when I'd left the unit to go to the toilet because I'd left patients in the room on their own. And I just thought, oh, I've had enough. So I bought a copy of the Nursing Times, and I saw this advertisement for a research midwife at St Thomas's Hospital in London for a year.
Yeah.
And I thought, I could do that. That sounds really interesting. What they wanted was someone who could do uterine artery Doppler assessment of blood flow for a study into preeclampsia. And I could do the test because obviously I scanned. And I knew a bit about preeclampsia, so I thought, I'll give it a go. I didn't actually think I'd be offered the job because I hadn't trained in London.
Yep.
And I'd obviously got my family was very much based in Kent. But actually what I really thought was, that'll show them if I apply for something else.
Show that somebody values me. Yep.
Yeah. Anyway, so I was really surprised when I got a phone call to say, would you come for an interview? And would I come? It was on a Friday. Would you come on a Friday? So I was like, yes, I can. But actually, I'm on a late. So I have to come early in the morning. So I've got to get into London and get home and get to work and sort out the kids and stuff. Anyway, and they went, yes, that's absolutely fine. Whatever time suits you. So I thought, okay.
Nice.
Anyway, yeah. So I went into London, did the interview. And I was interviewed by the head of midwifery, who at the time was Christina McKenzie, who was an amazing woman, a research doctor whose project it was going to be. It was Lucy Chappell, who's now a professor at King's and works for the NIHR in a leadership role as well. So she's doing really well for herself.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, the head of department is going to join you, Professor Lucilla Poston. And I thought, oh my goodness, I've never met a professor in my life before. And I was really nervous. And I just thought, oh my life. And Lucilla's, again, she's a scientist by background, and she's just the loveliest person. She was a really good advocate for me throughout my career. But she came in and she asked me one question. And I don't know if you know the program here, but there's a program in the UK called The Vicar of Dibley.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes.
Who goes, oh, no. Yes.
Yes.
Yep. And that's exactly what I did. She said, have you ever done any research? And I went, oh, no. And then I remembered that I'd done the old ENB 997 teaching clinical practice course. And actually I had. I'd done a little bit of research around third day hemoglobins in postnatal women, which we were doing routinely at the time and didn't really need to do and aren't done now. Anyway, I remember walking over Westminster Bridge to get the train back home with a Big Ben in the Houses of Parliament, thinking, oh, how could I be so stupid? I've met this woman and she's really impressive and I sounded like the bloke on the Vicar of Dibley. I went to work and I was working on the postnatal ward and they rang me at work. And one of the other girls said, oh, Annette, there's a call for you. And it was Lucy. And she said, oh, we'd really like to offer you the job. And I thought, oh, crikey. Really? And I actually had the presence of mind to say, oh, okay. Well, I can't say yes or no now because obviously I'm at work. And I really need to, I haven't seen my husband since I went to the interview. And I just need to make sure that although he was very supportive, that this is actually okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, so she said, oh, that's okay. She said, actually, I'm going to America on Saturday to learn about one of the tests we were going to use in this study. So she said, can you ring and speak to Lucilla, who is this
professor? Yep.
I'm thinking, oh, my goodness sake. So can you ring her on Monday and let her know? Or certainly, if not Monday, by Tuesday. So I said, yes, absolutely not a problem. And that Sunday in the UK was Mothering Sunday.
Yep.
And I just felt physically sick the whole day because I was so worried about ringing this woman. And my husband said, he was brilliant. He just said, Annette, it's a year. It's a year in your life. It's a part-time post. Tick the box on your CV that says done research and go back to what you were doing. You've got other skills, you've got a lot of clinical skill. You're a specialist as far as your scanning is concerned. You're not going to lose those skills in a year. Don't worry about it. Just go and do it for a year. And actually, I worked in the unit for 23 years.
It's almost like, and I liked it so much, I bought the company type attitude.
Well, I think it's quite interesting. I mean, research is not magic. It's not the hardest thing on the planet. It's very logical. You do have to be able to think outside the box. And I've had the privilege, when I went to St Thomas's, there was one other research midwife, Jenny Hawking, who was lovely, but she worked on one project and eventually she went on long-term sick leave and left. And gradually the team grew, as we got more grants and the unit developed. And I was really lucky because the unit was funded by Tommy's Charity, which is a charity in the UK that promotes research and supports research into pregnancy complications and pregnancy baby loss, really. So for most other people who go into research, you can be the best research midwife on the planet. But when the money ends, the job finishes.
Unfortunately.
As a midwife, that's not a problem. It's not like the scientists who are like, oh, crikey, what am I going to do now? You can always go back to clinical. And I've always really maintained a clinical focus, which for that reason in part. But each time a grant ended, if we were waiting for another one, Tommy's were always prepared to invest in me. But that came with a huge responsibility because I knew that were families who didn't have flowers at their babies' funerals. They made donations, and that supported my work. So it was a real motivator to be the best value I could be.
And I must admit, when I kind of first met you and listened to a talk that you were giving our students and you went through your CV, I was kind of just, after I'd cyber-stalked you, because obviously knowing you were coming to us, you've been involved in some amazing trials over the last few decades. So I'm going to ask you...
Too many decades, Liz, please.
Years. It's throughout your career. So I want to know two things. I want to know what study results surprised you the most in either a good or a bad way, and what was one of the hardest things about one of your studies?
Gosh. Well, I think all the studies have surprised me in one way or another, because I think if you go in there with any preconceived ideas as to what you're going to find, then you shouldn't be doing it, because you're going to introduce bias straight away. I think that open-mindedness is really important in what you do. I guess one of the, because obviously the project I went to St Thomas's to do, which was Lucy Chappell's PhD project, which was the first vitamins in preeclampsia study, was a small study, single centre, and we were looking at the pi 1, pi 2 ratio. So basically measurements of how the placentas were working in women who were at risk of preeclampsia, and half of them were randomised to vitamin C and vitamin E, and the other half were randomised to placebo. And we found that not only was the pi 1, pi 2 ratio improved, but there was a reduction in the incidence of preeclampsia in the vitamin supplemented group. So we then applied to the Wellcome Trust to get a grant to do a multi-centre study. And we did the main VIP trial, which was undertaken in 26 centres throughout the UK. So I then managed a team of midwives who were employed in other centres but were working for the study full time. So that was a really good, that taught me a lot about team management, team dynamics. How do you make a team feel the, or how do you make a midwife feel she's part of a team when actually she's working in Birmingham on her own, or in Manchester on her own, or in Newcastle on her own, or in Oxford on her own? You know, we were quite lucky. And that was as you've interviewed Jenny Carter already, she was the research midwife we employed on VIP in London. And I'm really proud to say that she's still there, and she's got her PhD now and is going from strength to strength. So, you know, that's amazing to see. So we were quite lucky because we had a bit of support from each other, but we were also providing support for other people, other midwives out in the centres. And Jenny was really good at that as well. So when we did the study, we recruited over 2,400 women to that study. And we found that actually the vitamin supplementation made no difference. So they're not in any of the risk groups. And I remember we went to the Wellcome Trust had funded it. So we went to their centre in Cambridge, and we had a conference with all the people that had been involved from up and down the country. And they'd already decided, Andy Shannon was the clinical lead and Lucilla Poston was the scientific lead, that whatever happened, I would be the one who would deliver the news, whether it was positive or negative.
Yep.
And it was both the worst and the best day of my life, really, because I had, the midwives were in tears because they were convinced it had worked. And there was one midwife who was absolutely lovely, and she was really good. She worked with Chris Redman, who's like Mr. Preeclampsia, really, in Oxford. And she said it might have worked in other, it might not have worked anywhere else, but it definitely worked in Oxford. It definitely worked on one of my women. And it was like everyone could think of one woman who had really severe preeclampsia, you know, numerous times in the past, or was really sick previously, who hadn't got it this time around. And, you know, I remember saying to her, Hazel, she wasn't going to get it this time. It's a random disease. She wasn't going to get it. It doesn't make any difference. And I think it was really important, because after the first study, women who'd had preeclampsia previously, or expecting twins, or, you know, and the medical profession as well, were suggesting, because it was vitamins that women supplement. Now, it was industrial doses. It was a gram of vitamin C and 400 international units of E. So 22 oranges and 140 avocados every day.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, you couldn't supplement it in your diet. It's industrial doses. But because they're readily available, relatively cheap, bought over the counter, people were beginning to self-medicate. And it was really important that practice stopped if it was doing no good.
Mm.
I did have Carl Hubel, who was one of the guys who first thought about the oxidative stress, which is obviously what these antioxidant vitamins were addressing, was the cause of preeclampsia. And we went to the SGI, the Society for Gynecological Investigation conference in America, to present the results. And the room was packed, standing room only, and Lucilla presented the results there. And you could hear when she said, when we went to each of the risk groups, no difference, no difference, no difference. You could hear there was this from everyone in the room, because everyone thought they wanted to be there when we found out what the cause of preeclampsia was, and it truly wasn't. And Carl came up to me at the end of it, and Lucilla, and said, "You've ruined my career. I've spent 25 years working on this theory, and it works in the laboratory on the mice." And I was like, "Don't work in women. It's wrong." Yep. You know, and so you've got to move on. And so I think, yes, I would have liked to have been famous for being the research midwife who ran the trial that cured preeclampsia, but hey-ho, not to be.
But the negative results, I think, are, as you just said, are just as important to talk about and to share, because otherwise, A, you're wasting money on products you don't need, but also what is the damage of overdosing on that for a longer period of time?
Well, absolutely. And you know, Caroline Crowther here in Australia, she had a trial that started after us and reported shortly after us exactly the same results. We worked with Jose Villar and Matthias Metanoglu in the World Health Organization, doing the same protocol in countries where the people were probably deficient in their diet. And again, it made no difference. And in fact, the study in the States was then pulled because of the evidence from the UK, from Australia, and from the WHO. It wasn't ethical to continue with their study, which is really, was really sad for them, but it was definitely the right call. And I'm just so proud of that piece of work because it wasn't the result everybody expected. It was pulled to pieces by, much, much cleverer people than me. And it was absolutely run perfectly.
Yep.
So, there was no ambiguity, there was no uncertainty, there was no questionable data about it. You know, when you think about some of the big trials of the past that have subsequently been shown not to be as reliable as they were first thought, that's quite an achievement. So that I guess was my first experience of a huge multi-centered study that I've managed. I guess I'm really proud of that piece of work, and it's still cited today. You know, when you look at your citations, you go, it's published in 2003.
Yep.
And it's like, oh, that's good. still being cited.
We still think about kind of the quick fixes or easy fixes, that because it's still preeclampsia is still as much an issue now, if not more.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I guess the other one that I was involved with, which Jenny Hawkin was involved with when I first went to St Thomas's, was a multi-centre study looking at antibiotic use, prophylactic antibiotic use, which at that time in the UK for women at risk of preterm birth, they were prescribed a different course of antibiotics almost every week of their pregnancy because everybody believed that it was ascending infection that was the problem. And therefore, if we sorted that out, then preterm birth would not happen. And it's really naive view with what we know today. So we did the Prenet trial, which was the first use of fetal fibronectin, and it wasn't the test it is today. It was, so we used to go to, there were 8 hospitals involved. We used to go out to the hospitals, take the swabs, put them in little containers that then went into like electric cool bags, bring them back to St Thomas's, and then we employed someone in the lab to run the test. So you'd run them on certain days, and then you'd ring the woman with the results. So it was like 2 or 3 days later. And so what we did was screened women who were had a history of previous preterm birth or a risk factor for preterm birth, and then get them to come along, and then we would swab them at 20, 21 and 25 weeks and take the swabs back to the UK, to St Thomas's, ring them with the results, and then if they were happy and they were positive, we would then prescribe, they were randomised to metronidazole or Flagyl and or placebo. And that study, we found that the women who had the antibiotics were twice as likely to have the babies early than the women who had the placebo. So again, it wasn't the response or the answer we wanted. But that was really important. And that antibiotic use, prophylactic antibiotic use to women at risk of preterm birth stopped almost overnight. It just stopped. And nowadays, all the NICE guidelines, all the PPGs that here in Australia, all state you only treat confirmed infection.
Yep.
So you know, I can, yeah, it's good, but you can see that something's made a difference.
Mm.
But it's, that, you know, these are the big ponderables, aren't they, really?
And there's one other you were talking about, position and epidurals.
Oh, the bump study.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's been loads. But yes, Bumps was a really good study led by Peter Brocklehurst, who is just awesome. He was at Birmingham most recently, and I believe he's actually retired and gone to France now. Not that I think he'll ever give up work. But if you want a difficult trial, then Peter Shaman. He takes on what other people wouldn't dream of taking on, because he just believes in finding the answers. Really nice guy, really good to work with, and probably one of the cleverest people I've ever met. But he so we had this idea, or it was a targeted call for funding, looking at positions in the second stage of labour for women with epidurals, who obviously with the idea that to ameliorate the effects of vaginal instrumental birth and cesarean sections in women who have epidurals. So we randomised in about 60, 67 centres or something. I can't actually remember how many. It was loads of centres throughout the UK. We randomised over 4,000 first-time mums with epidurals. In those posh words, but basically it was so the angle of the pelvis was below 45 degrees or more than 45 degrees. And we had real issues with this project. So we at St Thomas's, the midwives were like, but we know that if the women are upright, they're more likely to have a spontaneous vaginal birth. And I was like, do we? And they went, yes, of course we do. You know, stupid woman, who do you think you are? So I said to them, well, look, if you can find me the evidence that that is indeed true, and it's, you know, why do we need to do the trial? Then let's save the NIHR a huge amount of money and us a lot of time. And I will pull the study here. I was, initially, it's very sad actually. Initially, I wasn't the principal investigator at St Thomas's. And one of the anaesthetists was, but sadly, she passed away. And so I sort of inherited it from her. But Geraldine O'Sullivan was a huge, hugely popular and obstetric anaesthetist who asked all the right questions and did really good research and had done research for all of her career, and her loss was huge, obviously for her family, but for the hospital, but also for research. But she I can pull it here. I'll pull it here at St Thomas's, but actually I'm one of the investigators. So if you really can find that evidence, then we'll pull the trial, because it's not ethical to randomise women to a trial if we know the answer already. And anyway, I said, just let me know. That's absolutely fine. Anyway, a couple of weeks went past, didn't hear anything from anybody. So I wandered down to the labour ward. And guys, as Thomas is, it's really lovely because the research team are based on the 10th floor and the maternity services are on the 6th, 7th, and 8th. So you just up the stairs all day. So it's really, really good. And anyway, so I just nipped down and sort of said, well, you know, did anyone find any evidence? You know, can you tell me where it is? And they were like, well, it's embarrassing really, because actually there isn't any. okay. So are you happy now to recruit to this study? And they were like, yes. And actually, ultimately, guys at St Thomas's recruited the most.
And that's that buying in from the ground, getting that buy-in at the ground level.
Yeah. It's really important, I think. Research is integral to what we do. And you know, Liz, I say this a lot. I truly believe that when there's an equilateral triangle of service provision, education, because we've got to have a well-educated, highly skilled workforce with ongoing as well as basic education, and research, when they're equilateral, I think that's when it works really at its best for everybody. Unfortunately, I think the demands of education, making sure staff are skilled and competent in what they do, motivated, and service provision pushes out research, and it becomes an isosceles triangle, and the smallest side is always the research. But actually, you know, and in that equilateral triangle, I don't think it should be a group of people who do education, a group of people who do service delivery, and a group of people who do research. I think, you know, we all do all of it. You know, as I always say when we're at uni, you know, I'm not a natural teacher. I don't enjoy teaching the students. Actually, I love it when I do it. I just don't like the thought of it. It fills me with horror. Whereas I know, you know, it's your happy place. I think we all have the ability to do it, and we all should be involved in it. And I think that was one of the things that coming here to Australia, having come from St Thomas's and lots of other places in the UK through the multi-centre studies that I've worked on, because of the NIHR and the way research is managed in the UK, it is much more an integral part of it. It's much more normal for a midwife who might work full time, but she might do 3 days a week in research, 2 days a week in clinical, or she might do 2 days a week in education and 3 days a week in research. It's you've just got that greater flexibility. Whereas here, certainly my experience, and I can only talk about my experience, and I can probably only talk really about SA, is that people come in and do research. So again, because midwives aren't the cheapest people to employ in research, you can get a health sciences postgrad, easily and more cheaply. They helicopter people in to do the research, to recruit I would say women. I know men get recruited too, but, you know, to recruit the participants and then follow them up. And the midwives and the nurses and all the other allied healthcare professionals, as well as some of the docs, they know it's going on. They'll make sure there's a room for them. They'll make sure if the patient needs to see the researchers that they see them. But there's no bigger buy-in than that. And there certainly doesn't seem to be the feedback loop. So many years ago, I was involved in the SCOPE study, which was originated out of Auckland and recruited in London and Manchester and Cork in the Northern Hemisphere, which I was involved with, but also recruited here in Adelaide. And, you know, sometimes when I'm out at the North Adelaide Local Health Network of the La McEwen Hospital, where I have my joint appointment, I'll talk about the results of the SCOPE study. And there's people there who worked on it who don't know those results.
Yep.
Now, you could say, well, you know, they should be going and looking. But actually, if you've not been involved at all, how do you look? If you don't actually know who the chief investigator is or who the principal person was for a certain aspect of the study, how do you look up a paper? And who's got the time when you work clinically? You know, it's a real privilege to work in a university and a hospital setting because you do have that flexibility. So I find that I'm talking about results that were published, you know, in 2012, yes. Sort of 10 years ago. And they're, oh, yeah, we recruited to that. Oh, yes, I wonder what happened about
that. And I think that's actually a common statement from a lot of participants across the field. And I know with a lot of veteran participants and veterans that I've been involved in, one of their biggest banes and one of their biggest things that pisses them off is that they'll be asked to participate, but then they get never feedback. They don't get anything at all, and they're just feeling like they're being used and abused because dissemination isn't, it's dissemination into a high-ranking journal, but forgetting the fact that a limited people read that, it should be back to the people who you recruited from.
Yeah. So, and again, that is quite difficult because dissemination costs, when people put that into a grant, often they don't think about telling the participants. Now, I think that's really important. And certainly in the UK, they've got a much bigger commitment to patient participant engagement. So you have to show when you put in for Cat 1 grant, you have to show that you engage them at all levels, and you have to provide forums to feedback. So I know you, when you spoke to Jenny, she talked to you about the preterm birth support group that they put all our ideas go to. They generate ideas for us. They help us at every level. We also had one for obesity, because the last project that I was heavily involved with in the UK that was completed was Upbeat UK Pregnancies Better Eating and Activity Trial. So it is quite difficult. Now, to get a patient participant group together in pregnancy is quite tricky. So it's easier, and it's not easy, it's easier if you've got a problem. So like obstetric cholestasis, preeclampsia, obesity, preterm birth. The one you really, really struggled to, and we never managed to do in London while I was there, was a group of women who had a normal, uncomplicated pregnancy, labour, birth, and postnatal period. The other thing is that even those that have had the problem or are motivated to be involved, they are the sort of people who, as soon as that child goes to nursery or to school, they'll join the parent support group for that. So it's not like other PPI groups. So often if you've got cancer survivors, people who've had heart attacks, strokes, back pain, colds, whatever, once they've had them, their buy-in is there, and they buy in, and they buy in for life. Now, they used to be, I was the NIHR for the South London Clerk, which is an NIHR funded, very much frontline strategy for research. And I represented women's services on their group about PPI involvement. And the only guy who said to me, "You think you've got problems," was the guy who worked in palliative care. And he had exactly the same problem as me, that he'd get them, they'd be really good, really helpful, the families would be amazing. And then sadly the person would pass away, and then he'd have to start again. And it was exactly the same, that was the same pattern. So it is quite difficult. So going back to the VIP trial again. So the results, everybody thought the results of that study would prove that we found the cure for preeclampsia. So the other thing was that there were, when we did all the stats, that there was a slight trend towards the babies in the vitamin arm being slightly smaller than the babies born to women in the placebo arm. So we were a little bit worried that we'd get, instead of "Honey, I Shrunk the Kids," "Professor, You Shrunk My Baby" was going to be a headline in the papers. So we actually worked with Action on Preeclampsia, a UK charity, to produce a book, brochure, a leaflet that was sent on the Wednesday first class. So it would get there definitely by the Friday of the day that the paper was published in The Lancet. So all the participants knew the results in lay language before it was on the TV. And that was really important. And I think these days, when we use a lot of electronic data capture for our databases, it's not difficult to just make sure that you've got the ability to keep your site up for an extra month, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, to make sure that when the results come out, you can have a front page headline news. This is what we found, and just a phone number. So that day when those brochures went out to the women who'd taken part in Upbeat, Jenny will tell you as well, the phones rang white hot. Every time with the phone down, it rang again. It was a woman, "Can you tell me what I was randomised to? Can you tell me this?" And it was just like, we had about 3 or 4 days of absolute, it was dreadful. It was we were so busy, we were just on the phone all day long. So it is very, very important to disseminate the answers. And again, because my previous role was through Tommy's charity, they were really good at helping us disseminate results too. And here, half my post is funded through the Hospital Research Foundation. So I guess I would assume that once I've got any significant results, that I would go to them and say, "Okay, can you help me disseminate?"
And I think when you're looking at budgets, and people are putting in their budgets, it's really important to have an idea of how you're going to do that dissemination. We have open access. Yeah. That open access can cost anywhere between $2,000 and $5,000, depending on what journal we put in. Mm-hmm. But it does allow for everyone to have access to that information, and you're not dependent on firewalls and the big journals to get it. But also going to local medias and mainstream medias and thinking about what your dissemination strategy is actually going to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, most people, I have never had anyone, well, that's not entirely true. I did very sadly, I when we sent out the bit ones, I had a man rang me up and said, please don't send me anything else. My wife and son were killed in a road accident when my baby was 4 months old. Which, you know, you, if it had slapped me around the face with a wet fish, I couldn't have been more surprised. So that was it. But that's the only time I've ever had someone say to me, I didn't want to know. I didn't want to know the results. You know, and most of the time you get, usually you get a call going, oh, thank you so much. You know, that's just really helpful. And if you haven't got a budget, if you just, if you're using electronic data capture, just stick it up there. If you've got, you know, talk to the comms department in the hospitals where you recruited. Most of them will be really happy to put on their pages, these are the results of the study. Again, that's, an, you know, for me, that's another way for the staff to find out what's going on as well. So, because I think often, certainly in my experience, we're quite good at telling the patients what's going on, but sometimes the staff are the ones who miss out.
Because there is so much happening and they're trying to survive their daily stuff as well.
Yeah, so you've got to make it easily accessible. If you're talking to someone who's run ragged on labour ward as a jobbing midwife or in the community or anywhere really in maternity services, you know, then you go, oh yeah, you want to go and read this paper, it's published in The Lancet or PLOS One or, you know, one of the highfalutin journals. And it's like, if you're not used to reading academic journals, that's really tricky. So I think you actually almost need to do a lay summary. In the same way, you know, the Cochrane reviews do the lay person's summary. I think we need to be doing that, and that's what we need to be putting out, not just for our participants, but for the staff who, you know, whatever you say, they do facilitate it. Even if they just say to the woman, and we used to say at Guy's and Tommy's when I left, we had 67 ongoing clinical trials, mostly in pregnancy. So the clinical staff couldn't possibly know the details of all of those. So we used to say to them, just say, you might be eligible for a research project. Can I get one of the research midwives to call you? They're really nice and they'll answer any questions you've got. You don't have to do it, but can I just refer you? And then when they had done that, we would always make a point of going and speaking to the midwife or putting a note in her pigeonhole or sending a quick email just saying, you know, thank you so much. That woman was eligible and did participate, or that woman actually wasn't eligible because you know, people don't like to waste your time. But they used to use them in their PDRs. So they go and do their PDRs. I said, look, I've referred 30 women in the last year for different research projects. So, you know, it kind of works always. And then you're getting buy-in as well.
Which we need to do.
Because I know that if I talk to someone about any project, and explain it, and I'm the research midwife, I know that if and obviously in the UK they have more continuity of care here than here, but I know that if she says to the midwife who's taking her blood pressure, doing her routine antenatal or whatever, I spoke to Annette about research and I wasn't too sure. If that midwife raises her eyebrows, goes, and they don't have to say anything. And if they say, oh, I wouldn't get involved. Ooh, do you want to be a guinea pig? Anything, they'll say no. They've only got to be. So actually, you have got to get that buy-in from the clinical staff. Because even if they say, actually, I don't know anything about that, but it'd be a really good experience for you. And go find out more. And, you know, come back and tell me. Then they might say yes.
So before we get to your PhD, the results of the Bumps trial.
Oh, yeah. Yes. So the Bumps trial recruited women in the first with an epidural in the first stage of labour to be randomised to either the flatter position or the more upright position in the second stage of labour. And the women in the flatter positions were more likely to have a spontaneous vaginal birth than the women in the more upright.
So completely opposite to what the assumption was.
Completely. So you could hear a pin drop around the table of the investigators when the statisticians gave the results. And we were like, are you sure? I turned it around the wrong way. And they were like, no. And we then struggled like mad to get it published because all the journals were going, well, this isn't right. This can't be right. And it actually was right. And eventually we got it. We did get it funded in the British Medical Journal. And then it won the, I think it was 2017, the Research Paper of the Year. So, but it's still very hard to get it into practice. There's still people who don't believe that. And it's not about women. I must emphasize this is primates with an epidural. So it has, I can't tell you, it's not, presumably it's not transferable to to multips or to women without an epidural. Now, it might be the way the anaesthetic collects, that if they're more upright and they've got an epidural analgesia, it may make it a little bit more numb down below. So physiologically, it's hard to push out, so being flattened is better. There's all sorts of reasons why it might work in that group and not in others. We did put in an application, in fact, to get funding to do it in women without an epidural. But we were turned back both times. It would also be a really tricky trial to do because we would have to get a load of midwives on board in loads of different birth settings, which is much more difficult to control for all the other factors. So there could be more variables, whereas obviously if the women have got an epidural, there's a point at which they have the epidural, so there's an obvious point to speak to them about it. You can speak to them once the epidural is effective, so you're not too worried about them understanding or making a decision when they're stressed out or in pain. So there was all sorts of, but we thought we'd actually address most of those issues, and we thought it was a good project. But sadly, it wasn't funded. But it was just pre-COVID, so I think it probably did us a favour. You asked me about something else. You asked me about two trials.
What's something that you've had the most difficulty with? Is it kind of the recruiting? Is it the kind of the getting the buy-in? Like, what's been a really surprising but difficult thing in part of a study?
I think recruiting is always difficult, and it always seems that however conservative you are, or you could say pessimistic about recruitment always is always, there's always challenges to recruitment. So, but I think as time's gone on, I think we've got cleverer at it. So when we did Upbeat, we did a lot of work with Jane Sandel and social scientists, looking at how women wanted to be approached. And you have to remember, this was in 2014. So obesity wasn't discussed quite as openly as it is today. And a lot of the midwives who were going to be recruiting were really worried about how you talk to a woman because she had a BMI over 30. And so we spent a lot of time with the midwives who were going to be recruiting, and also with clinical midwives. But I hope that it will be a cascade effect by the research midwife having the lingo and being confident with it, that would actually rub off onto some of the clinical staff. So we did a lot of work around the terms they liked to be used, and they didn't like obesity because that was medical. They didn't like fat, surprisingly, not. There were lots of things they didn't like. But the preferred term was heavier. Yep. So we then wrote the patient information leaflets and all the documentation and spoke to them in terms of, you know, we're recruiting people heavier. And that was great. You know, that worked really, really well. I mean, it has been tricky. There have always been people who you've, particularly in that study, I guess, you have upset because you've highlighted that. And certainly in those days, I don't think it's the same now, but when we were first recruiting, a lot of the heavier women thought that during pregnancy would be one time people would not comment on their weight. Whereas I think now people know that they will. And also the adverse events associated with being heavier at the beginning of pregnancy are much more known. You know, there've been loads of studies around the world. So that's how I first came to Adelaide, was because we linked with Jodie Dodd's group, who were doing the Linux study. But you know, then there was Rolo in Southern Ireland. There was the Rotterdam project in the Netherlands. There's another group in Murcia in Spain, and then we became part of an EU collaboration called Early Nutrition. I think just that stronger together remit has really worked. But I think you just have to really think about how you would want to be approached if it was you that was being recruited. And I guess one of my rules of thumb is I never really, well, certainly not for a long time now, been involved in a study that if I wasn't eligible for it, I wouldn't do it. I think that's, for me, that's a sanity check. You know, and now I'm so old, into old age. But you know, would I be happy for my daughter if she was eligible to do this? And so I think it's those types of things. And I think also, that's really important. And when I first started in research, and you know, I will correct Jenny Carter, I was not the first ever research midwife, I'm not quite that old. But when I first started, it was very much the protocols were developed by very clever people, but not with a lot, well, not with any patient or participant involvement, and not with any nursing or midwifery or allied healthcare professional involvement. So it was very medicalized. You know, I remember arguing when we were doing the Vic trial, the big one, there was a really clever guy there who's a scientist from, I think it's from Leicester or somewhere, but anyway, he thought it was really, really would be interesting to look at the vitamin C content of amniotic fluid at 36 weeks gestation in both arms of the study. And I can't remember what the rationale behind it was, because actually by then I was so horrified that he thought we would recruit women and at 36 weeks ask them to have an amniocentesis for research for no good reason. I was like, no, you can't do that. No, you definitely can't do that. And in fact, Lucilla, you know, said, looked at me and went, do you not think that would go down well? I went, no, not at all. I said, I don't think the midwives would be happy to do it, and I don't think the women would too. And what would happen if you damaged the baby, or what would happen if they went into labour, or what would happen if you introduced some sort of infection? And also, who's going to do it? Where are they going to do it? And how are you going to... So it's all the logistic stuff. And Lucilla turned around to him and just went, that's it, we're not doing it. And then he says no. And now I guess I would expect that kind of input, that kind of practical input to come in, which means that some of the people who are very clever but sit in their ivory towers don't necessarily know what is acceptable to women or to any other participants, to any other trials, really. So I think midwives are, you know, I would say I haven't delivered a baby for a while, but my midwifery is my route, my complete route, and it would be, if you take my midwifery away, you take everything away. But I'm a real advocate for the woman in the research, and I think that's just really important. And I think being involved in research is amazing. And you've heard me say this before, Liz, but you know, Claire Singh, who was my matron, who stalked me for the job on Upbeat. She really wanted that job, and she got it. And like me, was bitten by the research bug. And eventually became the matron, although now she's a lecturer at King's College London and midwifery, so the students are really lucky to have her. But she said in the interview for her matron's role, as a midwife, I can make a difference to one woman, one family, one at a time. As a research midwife, I can make a difference to a generation. And I just think, well, I wish I'd said it, because I think that's absolutely brilliant. And it's so, so
true. And it brings back the importance of actually having that kind of consumer buy-in when you're doing the designing of the stage to kind of work out whilst we can do so many theoretical questions of what ifs, what cans, it's the reality of it.
I think it's also really important to know what the research priorities are for the population. So I think, you know, we can think we know what's right. So I remember working many years ago now, well, not that many, but quite a few, we were working with teenagers, and it was really, we wanted to know why teenage pregnancy was associated with poorer outcomes than pregnancy in older women, and you know, so sort of plus 25 to below 20. And we assumed that we did the study anyway, and the theory was that it was that the mother was still growing, and therefore there was a competition for nutrients between the fetus and the mother. Anyway, but we had assumed that the participants who were awesome would want an app or, you know, a podcast or something. What they wanted was a book. They wanted a book that was like other mothers got, but wasn't like other mothers got, because they thought that even the pictures that we thought were of young women were too old. So actually, in the end, several of them went to a photo shoot for us during their pregnancy and afterwards and made their own book. So, you know, it was awesome. But, you know, what we thought they wanted wasn't what they wanted at all. And I think that's a really, I think we know women and we know pregnancy, but we've got to be really cognizant of listening. Yeah.
We talked about a mere handful of the studies that you've been involved in. So why the hell did you do a PhD? If you're already involved in all these studies as a principal investigator, you're already doing this stuff. What did a PhD mean?
Well, I never meant to do it, really. It was an accident.
Something you don't hear every day.
Like most of my life. I've never really had a career trajectory, and I've never gone on. You know, when people, I always ask at interviews, blue sky thinking, where will you be in 5 years? Where will you be in 10 years? Because it's actually the question I hate, because I have no idea. Going back to my drama queen A&E days, I love the drama of pregnancy and difficult. I love it when a woman who probably shouldn't have a baby or years ago wouldn't have had a baby, we get her through a safe pregnancy and she has a take-home baby. I get a real kick out of that. And also everything I have done has been very related to clinical work. And it really galls me that in resource-rich countries with a whole toolbox of an armory to address postpartum hemorrhage, still women bleed to death.
Yep.
And so I was talking to Professor Susan Bewley, who's now retired but was at Tommy's, and she's always been fascinated with PPH and a lot of other things like domestic violence and interpartner abuse and that type of stuff. So she's amazing. And she and I sort of sat down and said, the PPH rate is going up and up and up. And we were like, well, what is changing? And we weren't terribly sure. So we thought, well, okay, let's put together a grant between us and do this piece of work. So what we aimed to do was, what we really wanted to work out was whether it was going up because we all know about the pre-pregnancy risks. We all know about the pregnancy risks and we all know about the intrapartum risks. But what we wanted to know was it going up because there was a cumulative risk? So if you had a pre-pregnancy risk, so if maybe you had a high BMI or you were elderly, and then you had, a pregnancy acquired, so maybe you had a twin pregnancy or you had preeclampsia, and then you were induced or you had a long labour or you had a quick labour or whatever, was that three times the risk because you'd got one from each category? So we decided to do an observational study, prospective observational study, and we did it in two sites. But we also used a weighted sampling strategy because we didn't just, most of the information out there looks at the worst, the major obstetric hemorrhage, the really worst case scenario. But, is a major obstetric hemorrhage a smaller hemorrhage that was poorly managed?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it going to be that big anyway? Or if you have a moderate hemorrhage, is that because it was well managed, or should that not have happened? Is it about management? So we decided that we would recruit a selection of women who had normal blood loss, and then so I think it was 1 in 12 cases. So randomly selected 1 in 12 cases, and then if they had 501 to 1,000 mils, it was 1 in 6. And everyone who lost more than 1,000 mils, 1,001 plus, we looked at all their case notes. And we looked at what had happened, what their history was and what their management was, and developed a grid confirming some well-known age-old risk factors, confirming some new ones, actually, but then looking using multiple regression analysis, working out which ones were significant. And it was really interesting. The intrapartum stuff overweighs everything, outweighs everything else. But we also could then look at what constituted or what contributed to normal blood loss, even in women who were potentially high risk because maybe they were obese to start with. So that was really interesting. And then we also wanted to talk to the women, their birth partners, and the clinician involved in the blood loss. in what happened. Particularly, we didn't do that so much for the normal blood loss, but for those that lost more than 500, so a PPH of any measure. And then, so we got it all together and we got £365,000, so that's about $800,000. Something like that, from the guys in St Thomas's charity, which is an amazing charity that supports work within the trust to improve patient outcomes. Anyway, as we got it all together, Lucilla and Susan and a few others were like, this is your PhD, isn't it? You should just write this up as a PhD because you're going to be doing the work anyway. You've devised the project, you've done everything. You know, what are you waiting for? And I was like, really? Anyway, in the end, I thought, okay, fine. Now, there was a few times when I thought, that's not such a good idea. So I did it by accident, really, just by running the project.
So that experience would be a lot different to what a lot of other midwives have gone through doing their PhDs. But I'm going to ask you the same question as well. How did you keep your sanity through it all? Was it just another job, therefore it was kind of just usual, or was there the extra pressure of needing to actually produce this document at the end that goes into far more depth and detail than a normal report?
It was a nightmare, really, because I had within the grant, I had a day a week for someone for 2 years. And I was managing Upbeat as a multi-centre study and overseeing a lot of other things. I was also R&D lead, managed the team. I was NIHR advocate for careers in research, the NIHR midwife champion and the NIHR specialty lead for South London. So it was a complete and utter nightmare. It's typical adult learning. No sooner had I registered that my father was diagnosed with motor neurone disease and passed away before we got to the end of it, but then my mother broke her hip and I had kids going to university and dropping out of university and all that was kind of going on as well. And actually, when I look back now, I don't actually know how I did it. My supervisors were Professor Jane Sandel, who everybody knows, and Professor Rachel Tribe, who was a physiologist, a scientist. Because she has spent a lot of her life's work, looking at uterine contractility, trying to work out what goes wrong for preterm birth. So again, it was a completely different way around. And from your conversation with Jenny Carter, she had exactly the same supervisor as me, but she had Rachel as her first supervisor and Jane as her second, and I had the other way around. And there's a lot of pressure doing a PhD in your working environment, as you know, Liz. It was quite stressful. Looking back, I loved it because it was totally mine, as opposed to everything else which I shared. And I'm a team player. That doesn't matter. But it was quite tricky. And I remember going to, I don't know that you do it here, but we have an upgrade, which basically, I think it's probably
confirmation.
Your confirmation, but it's a way in. And it's usually done with people that are external to the project, but internal to the organisation. And I did mine with Deborah Bick, Professor Deborah Bick, who's now at Warwick, and Professor Andy Shannon, who's still at King's. And I worked very closely with both of them. And I got myself in a real state about it. And I ended up sobbing my heart out in the middle of it, which really didn't go down well. And because Andy said to me, I don't know why you're so worried about this. And I was like, oh, no, I am. And I think it was about that bearing your soul. It was like, you know, I'd always managed, they thought I was reasonably competent. And I'd always managed to pull it out of the bag. But this was truly mine. And so it was like, you know, taking all my clothes off. It was like they were going to see the heart of me. So I really struggled with that. Then Andy said some really nice things about me, and that was it. Once I started, I couldn't stop crying. So Deborah was handing me tissues. So no one else's upgraded interview could be as bad as mine. But yeah, I mean, it is really hard. And I know when I got to the end of it, I got to kind of like 4 years-ish, or three and a half years. And I decided at that point I'd got to do it in a year, because it was just going on too long. And I was really lucky. I had, by then, Lucilla had said to me, right, just take a day a week, every week, do your PhD. And actually, a day a week wasn't really useful at that point. I needed more time. So in the end, it was like 2 days a fortnight. So I'd have 2 days together and then the weekend. And I used all my holiday and everything just to really put it out of the bag in the last year. And I remember we decided we were going to go to New Zealand for a holiday. And I said, I'm going to hand it in beforehand. And Jane said to me, do you really want to hand it in now? And I was like, well, I do. I want to get rid of it. She said, I think if you went away for a month, which is what I was going for, and came back, it would be better. You could then look at it with fresh eyes. And you could then. And so we went to New Zealand in November. So I waited and I handed it in January, because there's no point handing it.
Not be Christmas time, no.
No. And that was a good feeling. But when I spoke to people outside of work, and they were like, well, you know, do you get more money for that? Do you get promotion? Like, you know, nothing. And they were like, really? And there were times in the intervening years before I got the job here that I'd say, I don't know why I bothered, really. And then when I sent Laura McGee an email, who's one of the obstetric physicians that I used to work with at King's. She's actually Canadian. I sent her an email just to say, you know, I'm going to go to Australia. She was like, oh, it was worth doing that PhD then. That was her response to me. I was like, yeah, I guess it was. I think it's really good. I think it's, I did it to validate everything I'd done before, and that's the difference. Most people do it to step into research, and actually I just did it, but I did it so that I could argue on an even playing field with people who have got a PhD. And even with all the research that I had done, it was still a very different experience.
So how did you celebrate finishing it and getting the results back?
We had a party, a huge party, in the local golf club in the village that I live in the UK. Invited everybody, because you know, the African saying that it takes a village to raise a child. It certainly takes more than a village to raise a PhD. And it was amazing. It was just a really good celebration. So it was excellent. Yeah, the band played and everyone danced. I remember Jane Sandal, her husband said, shall we go home now? And then the band started playing Ruby Ruby by Coldplay. And she was like, no, I need to dance. I need to dance.
Everyone's always got that one song that keeps them there.
Yeah, but again, so my phone's ringing, but I'm not going to answer it. But again, you know, they were like, Debs was there, you know, everyone was there, the statisticians, everyone. They were like, oh yeah, this is a PhD party like no other. So yeah, it was worth doing. So no, I definitely think you should have a party.
So one of the things that I kind of keep hearing with conversations with people, and particularly different midwives, is they think they're not smart enough to do a PhD. They think that there's no point in doing a PhD. So for those midwives who kind of have got that questioning bug, that want to know, why do we do something? How can we do something better, more importantly, but think they're not smart enough to do it? What advice can you give them?
I don't think it's smart. I don't think smart's what it's about. I think it's about application. I don't think there's anyone in the world who's no good at anything. I think it's about choosing what really presses your buttons, because you're going to live and breathe it, and actually you are going to be known for it in the future. So I mean, I guess if you're uncertain, if it's because you want to do it but you're not sure whether you should do it, then I guess get a job in research, get a job, do a bit of research midwifery, and just see how it sits with you. You know, as I said right at the very beginning, I failed my maths O level, which is why I couldn't go to art school. But I did multiple logistic regression for my PhD. So, you know, I don't have a maths O level, which is, you know, just how it is. So, you know, I just, But again, you know, I wasn't interested in what N equaled or what X equaled back then, but I was very interested in my PhD project. So, and I would still say, you know, there's still aspects of it. The maths I really struggled with. You know, it was really, really hard. Analysing the qualitative data, sorting all that out was a piece of cake in proportion, in comparison. But actually, a PhD should stretch you. What really worries me more than that is I really think we need to have proper career pathways for midwives who want to be this, to have these high degrees. And that is, I think that is really sad, because I do think for a lot of people, they do it and then there's nothing. There is no, and in fact, sometimes if they're clinical, their employers make it even harder for them to do anything. You know, they load them up with clinical stuff, or they get loaded up with teaching. They get all the students coming through, which they're not telling them about their PhD. They just, because they're highly educated, you know, everyone's highly educated if you're a midwife. So I think, and I think that's where medicine is like light years ahead of any of the allied healthcare professions. And actually midwifery is quite small. If you look at like the numbers of nurses, numbers of physios, midwives are actually quite a small group. So I think we need to learn from those people who are maybe a little bit ahead of us. But I do think we need to have plans in place. And, you know, in the UK, they've got the NIHR system, which I know Jenny spoke to you about, which she's availing herself of all the steps through. But they're highly competitive. And she sold herself very short in her podcast, because she's a really good candidate and she works really hard and she deserves everything she gets. But they are really competitive. So, and she also works in an environment which she's supported to do that. It's really hard if you're a clinician to have the academic support to get to those places. And it's really hard if you're in a university because you haven't got the clinical attribution for a joint scholarship, fellowship, whatever. So I think there's all sorts of issues around career progression. And I also think that partly because of COVID, and maybe it's the silver lining, the healthcare delivery is changing, and we're not going to go back to what it was pre-COVID. There'll be some sort of modification. So it's about how can we fit that all in so that we maintain midwives' interest, but also give them a career trajectory that will maintain them. For maybe, you know, people aren't retiring early anymore. You know, people often are, if you qualify as a midwife, you know, as I did, in 24 when I qualified, you know, you're going to be working for 45 years probably to retire in your late 60s. And it's a long time if you haven't got clear pathways. And I think we really need to be lobbying for specialist roles, for us to be able to use these higher degrees. And for it not to be shutting you down, because you know if you're a medic and you do a PhD or an MD, it's almost like a fast track to promotion. Whereas if you're a nurse or a midwife or a physio or anything else, an allied healthcare professional, it's almost like the lid's on you. So you know, a lot of people will choose to do a part-time PhD, because that means they keep their foot in the clinical camp or the university camp. You know, I have heard of people, and know people, who have taken 3 years out to do a PhD and then not got a job when they finished, because the clinical side say, oh, well, actually, you haven't been around for 3 years, so you're not relevant, or, you know, you've got to do a bit of updating or whatever. And the university say, well, you've got a PhD, but you haven't actually got any teaching experience. And it's really hard. And you know, to go in as a new postdoc and get a grant that would support your salary as well as the whole project, you know, the whole of your salary, is really tough.
And getting tougher and tougher. It's not. And that's where we've got a whole pile of issues greater, and which is why Australia needs a chief midwife, at least as a start, to then start advocating at those levels, to then bring in a position of research with midwifery research that Jane's doing over in the UK. So
absolutely, but you've got to remember that the UK is, because of the NIHR that came in 2006, you know, we've got 15 years on you here. So you know, and Jane's only been in post probably not a year yet, or maybe coming up for a year. I think she started February this year. So it's taken a while, but I think we need to be seen, not to be militant or difficult, but just to be realistic. You know, there is a global shortage of midwives, and so what we've got to do is make sure we've got high quality training that brings in young people, that it's seen as a career that is a career for life, and that you're not just going to be stuck. Some people, I've got a friend, God love her, she's been she works at a standalone birth centre in the UK, and she delivered my great nephew a few months ago now, and she's like the best midwife on the planet, and she's really happy. She's like band 6 there, so level 1 here, jobbing midwife, and that's all she wants to do, go in, do her shifts, go home, and she's just amazing, and she's maintained her interest just at that level, doing her mandatory training each year, and you know, she's fantastic. But for a lot of midwives, that isn't enough. You know, I always think I want to be on the labour ward, and certainly in my experience in the UK, I'd go down to the labour ward and I'd be there a little while, and I think, oh yeah, I'll take us now. So it'd be a little bit more challenging. Because actually, I mean, I guess that goes back to me liking the drama and the difficult cases. But I think I think we need to look out for ourselves. And if we don't stand up for ourselves as a highly educated and motivated workforce, no one's going to stand up for us.
No, absolutely. And we need to do it.
I don't think midwives should be put off doing PhDs because there's no career pathways. But I think it's beholden on us who have got them to kind of make sure that those pathways are created and developed further.
It's forging the path for those who come behind.
Yeah, and on a bad day when I think, gosh, this is really hard, I think, no, I'm a trailblazer. I'm a trailblazer, which is, you know, and I think a lot of the people that you've spoken to are, and it's just, you know, this your series of podcasts have got together, you know, an amazing set of midwives. And I think it's quite reassuring for others who maybe are feeling the pressure, and everyone's feeling the pressure at the moment. You know, the birth rates are going up and the midwife numbers are going down, and the complexity that women come into pregnancy with, you know, a generation ago, they wouldn't have been able to have a baby. So I think, you know, it's very different to how it used to
be. And I think every midwife who does a PhD is a trailblazer and will continue to be a trailblazer in their own way, which is why it's an endless possibility of future changes and management of treatment. Thank you very much for your time and for your contribution into everything, because we've literally only touched on a handful of trials that you've been involved in, and it's really quite fun to sit there and kind of go, oh wow, and to be part of that, especially down here in Australia, because a lot of it you go, well, this kind of PPG has been updated because of this trial. And then to realise that linkage, reality linkage in it, to me has actually been quite a privilege. So I thank you from my behalf as well as for everyone else listening.
Bless you, Liz. It's been lovely coming to Flinders. It's been, you know, everyone's been so, so welcoming. And I just hope I can continue to make a difference.
I think you will.
Thank you for joining us today. You'll find all the links on Twitter, Instagram and on the podcast website. If you are a midwife and you would like to share your research, your postgraduate studies, or even the quality improvement projects you are doing now, then email me at throughthepinard@gmail.com. Send me a tweet or send me a DM.